As you noticed, I was away from you for a number of days, and what is more, I left without mentioning that I would be away. That, of course, gave some people occasion to misunderstand my absence and even to reach the point of sinning in their own way. And this happened because they were not attentive or because they have not yet advanced far enough to enter into the mysteries of God. Beyond their own little self, they see nothing else. And they do not even see that self, because if they saw it, they would guard it from their own tongue. They did harm to themselves, and perhaps they also harmed a few others who are weak. For the umpteenth time, I would like to tell you that God directs all things. If you believe that I am speaking here tonight by chance, or that you happen to be here tonight by chance, because you alone wanted it, or because I alone wanted it, that is a pitiful delusion. Because wherever there is a speaker and a listener, if the listener has not been led or is not being led by the Holy Spirit, or if the Holy Spirit is not present, then all are led astray. Christ told us plainly, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst of them." And if we had read at least the Acts of the Apostles, we would see that the grace of the Holy Spirit was always with both the speaker and the listeners, guiding the heart and the words. Lydia, who listened to the words of Paul, was a distinguished lady, a woman of standing, as we would say, and financially independent. Who was it that brought compunction to her heart, so that she embraced Christianity and became one of the first converts from among the Gentiles? Christ opened her heart, it says. So we are not alone here tonight, nor have we been on all those other evenings during the nearly 30 years that I have spoken in this upper room. There is another here who sees the hidden depths of the human heart. Another who arranges, another who commands, another who decides, another who sows, another who opens hearts, another who gives the increase, another who reaps. There is another, and in every case a person must live under the fear of that other. And when I say fear, I do not mean fear in the way we human beings use the word. I mean reverence, that a person should take him into account. For to fear God means to revere God, to reckon with God. The wife is to fear her husband, that is to respect her husband, to reckon with him, to take him into account, to honor him, to lift him up. I say all this sadly, because in these past few days, these things have come to the surface, and they have shown that we are still not what we ought to be. We have been listening for so many years. In any case, each person would reasonably have wanted to be told something in advance. I had nothing definite to announce officially last Thursday when I left here. Nothing to tell you that I would be going abroad. I had no definite word. Things were in motion, but no final decision had been taken. I did not have 100% certainty that it would happen. I truly did not know whether the consulate would grant me a visa to go. Nor did I know how matters would ultimately turn out there with the archdiocese and everything else. I did not know whether I myself had the qualifications, the strength, and everything else needed to make this journey. You may ask how, then, all these things came about within just a few days. But you see, the one who devised the plan was not man. He was God. And when it is God, everything lies open before him. But I don't have the gift of prophecy to see ahead and read the mind of God. I had to wait. And so I left here without even saying goodbye, and without even asking for your prayers, which I would have needed so much, however limp or lukewarm they might have been. This is how a person who thinks with humility ought to act. If a Paul asked for the prayers of his fellow men, imagine what a Panagopoulos ought to do. At the same time, I wanted, and if I had known, you would have said something to me, you would have spoken about it. Even then I would have thought twice. I am telling you how the matter stands. I would still have wondered whether I ought to say it, because, sadly, I know the mentality. We have reached the point of not looking at what is being said, but at who is saying it. Not what the speaker says, but who the speaker is. Sadly, we have received the anointing, so to speak. Panagopoulos is going to speak. Never mind what nonsense Panagopoulos is going to say tonight will go, because it's Panagopoulos who's speaking, and the other man, what is he, suppose, for example, he is a Roma man, but he is handing out gold sovereigns. You'll go and take the sovereigns from him, of course you'll go, you're no fool. But here now, you don't go, do you? So they know this mentality. The congregation would be thinned out, and that what people might have gained from another man who has received God's mercy would be lost. Because I had my own calculations to make. If I am away, whom shall I ask to go to the first sermon, whom to the second, whom to the third? I give 6 different talks around Athens every week. This sermon of mine is not the only one. There are many others across Athens. I have just come from another one. I am coming from Patesia at this very hour. I spoke there, and now I have come here. Who could go and speak to each group? Being only human, I made my own assessment. So I thought it best to have an experienced man come here, one who was also spiritually mature. A man with the simplicity of a little child, raised in a spiritual family, with experience of the monastic life, surely he too would have something edifying to say. After all, just as we pick seeds and bones out of our food and throw them away, it is up to us to keep what is nourishing from whatever another person offers us, especially a priest of God, and discard the rest. Was I absolutely obliged to accept and absorb everything the other person offered me? Are you obliged to keep and digest everything I'm saying now, have said here for so many years, or may yet say? No. You are free to choose and keep whatever you wish, whatever you believe will benefit you, and discard the rest. So, unfortunately, I knew that mentality. The proof is the telephone calls we got today. You'd think I was a member of Parliament. I was at the shop at 3 o'clock, as Raphael tells me, and the whole time I was there it was. Has Panagopoulos arrived? Is he speaking tonight? Has Panagopoulos arrived? Is he speaking tonight? Has Panagopoulos arrived? He said it was. As though they had an automatic answering service there, with calls coming in from all over Athens. Had Panagopoulos arrived? Had Phosterus arrived? If Panagopoulos dies, what will happen? Well, perhaps the sun will hide its rays. Orthodoxy will be lost. The church will be lost, and you yourselves will be lost. In other words, you do not believe in God. You do not believe. On the day you heard that Panagopoulos is away, not just away from Athens, but out of Greece altogether, gone somewhere else, our wish is that you would say a prayer or two. We pray that our sinful prayers go with him, and that God shelter you and bless you, and that you hold this pulpit worthily until he returns. That is what a Christian's prayer should have been, not these outbursts that happened and unsettled everybody. Not even the president knew. I had not told the president. I did not know myself. And then they telephoned me in Boston to write and reassure the president here. So now you understand what goes on. But this is also one of those moments that, I say it again, shows we have not yet become Christians. I came back Sunday evening. I had gone for 14 days, and I stayed 20. Of course, as things are there, I could have stayed even 20 years. From the day I arrived at the airport, where people came to meet me and welcome me, and I thanked them for that, right up to today, I have been pressed to share my impressions. As I told you, I have been speaking here for so many years. You have heard sermons and preserved them in your recording libraries, and God has counted us worthy to write around 65 book titles. You already have a great deal. There's a great deal to tell, so listen tonight as well, since the others are pressing me for this favor, to my impressions of the other hemisphere, from America and from Canada, because I spent 10 days in Canada too, in Montreal. In those 20 days I was there, I gave 26 talks. Every single evening I had a talk, both in Canada and in Boston, which is a city of 2 million people, and in Montreal, which is a city of 3.5 million. What will come out in general terms from what I'm going to tell you is this: many of us have relatives abroad in those places, and many of us have gone there ourselves and have tasted what I am about to describe. I will now speak of the general conclusion that emerges, and of my purpose, to yield to this weakness of mine, and to the brother's request that I say something about it. My aim is not to promote myself, but to make known the work of God, a work that clearly comes from God, and to ask that we reconsider, in a general way, our views concerning those who live outside Greece. We tend to think that Orthodoxy exists only in Greece. If we go elsewhere, and those who went to Bulgaria and others who went to Romania, we will see that perhaps it is only in Greece that we do not have orthodoxy. We are of the opinion that God died for us alone. We have fallen into the same thing as Peter, who thought that Christ had come only for the Jews. And our Christ had to show him, you remember, that great sheet with the unclean animals inside it, and so on. And when he said to him, "Rise, kill, and eat," Peter answered, "By no means, Lord. These things are unclean." He said to him, "What I have made holy, you must not call unclean. Do not call unclean what I have made holy." In this way he helped him, and afterward he went to the Gentiles, preached, baptized, and so on. Indeed, the Holy Spirit had gone before him. The Holy Spirit went first. If you read the Acts of the Apostles, you will see that the Spirit went first. When Peter saw that the Holy Spirit had come upon the nations, then he says, "What is to stop us from baptizing them?" And so he baptized them. He baptized them. Unfortunately, we have a prejudice here, an idea of our own, that we are the Orthodox. It is true that we have many helps here to enable us to become truly Orthodox, yet we do not know exactly to what degree we are Orthodox and faithful in the eyes of God. After all, right, belief without right conduct means nothing. And likewise, right conduct without right belief means nothing. And we must understand, we should know that God will judge things as the fathers say and as Paul says too. Not on the surface and not by one single measure. He has many measures. When each person lived how they lived, under what conditions they lived, what circumstances they had, what advantages they had when it came to believing and acting, all of it will be taken seriously into account. Saint Mary of Egypt ate roots for 46 years. She took 2 loaves of bread and crossed the Jordan. And yet Zosimus still had to bring Holy Communion out to her. Someone had to go and hear her confession so that she could be saved. That is not how one is saved on one's own. She flew through the air. She really did fly through the air, but she still could not enter paradise. These matters call for many fine distinctions. It is not that we too are saved by a single Holy Communion, but if the conditions are such that you cannot come near, and you come near only once in a great while, even then God has a way, and he can make you a saint as well, if the other conditions are there. And we here will be judged more strictly, because we have everything. From the moment we are conceived in our mother's womb, the bell is ringing outside, and we draw ourselves together, we feel awe. And from the moment we are born, we will see priests in front of us, we will hear bells, we will see Byzantine icons, we will hear sermons, catechism classes, and the rest. Those people over there, here we are, one Christian among 100 Christians, there they are, one among 100 Antichrists, and still they keep the faith, they keep the clergy, they keep the church, they keep the language, they keep their Greek heritage, and so on and so on and so on. Things which we here have largely done away with. So this will be taken into account, how each person lives and why they do not do the things we do. It is not a light matter for us to hand out grades, to judge them and to criticize them. But I tell you, if God counts you worthy to go there and look at it objectively, you will say, "My God, are you here too? In this little handful of people, in these people who to all appearances have drifted away, are you here?" And he will say to you, "Yes, I am here more, and there where you are, less." You don't get to tell me where I'll go. I decide where I go. You think you give me orders, that you've got me tucked away under your oilless Lenten bean soup, and all the while your tongue has eaten right through the veil of the temple, and your eyes have swallowed all the corruption of the world through the modern media, no less, which we don't even have to go looking for, rather, they come looking for us right in our own room. If there is any sincerity in you, you will revise these thoughts of yours. And I was the first to do exactly that. The reason I went there was the founding of a new community, a new parish, in honor of Saint Nectarios. A newly formed community bought a church from the Catholics for $200,000, which they are paying off in installments little by little, and they converted it into an Orthodox church. Then the whole community was called to vote on what name they would give the church. And they voted in secret, each one cast his ballot, and among the 500 and some souls who voted, 450 and more were for Saint Nectarios, a saint who was strange to them, a saint who was unknown to them. That is why, in a talk I gave one evening, the very evening of the feast at Vespers, I said, "The saint was laid upon you here. He came to you, you did not bring him, and for him to come here means he loved you very much." For he was a man who always lived as a stranger in foreign lands, and the burden of exile weighed heavily upon him. And he will come to help you, and you will prosper. And this icon that is there today, I tell you, a beautiful Byzantine icon, but without votive offerings or dedications, just wait and see what will be placed before it by next year. You will not be able to see the saint's image because of all the offerings made in thanksgiving for the miracles he will perform here. And when I returned from Montreal, before leaving for Athens the next day, I stopped there and found that 7 offerings had already been dedicated. Thank you. So the first Nectarios stood there. The first name that was set up in that place was Nectarios. Anyway, that was the reason. And God arranged things so that they would learn that the one man who could speak to them about Saint Nectarios was me, from Greece. They gave the name, they discussed it, and so on. And so the rest of the process was set in motion, for me to fly out there. The ticket I bought ran from 14 days up to 60. If I had wanted to come back on the 13th day, I could not have. I would have lost the discount. And I'd have had to pay about 15,000 more. So it became necessary for me to stay the full 14 days. I couldn't leave any sooner. And that's exactly why I ended up with days to spare. And since they invited me to go on from there, the trip was extended, and I went further on in that direction. And I stayed there another 10 days until I left. That was the reason I went. I went there guarded. I admit it because of the things I had been hearing here, that there is no orthodoxy over there, that this is missing, that is missing, and so on. I went guarded. I had tied my tongue and I said, "Lord, you are the one sending me there, something I never aspired to, never sought out. I have no credentials for it. I do not have the language for getting around. I see that you have done this. So you see to it as well what we are going to say." And I must admit, I was very guarded. But I wanted my tongue to remain tied as well. I did not want it to loosen there because I had no clear idea, generally speaking, of what I myself was going to say. For every one of our people who goes there comes back criticizing and telling you the same things. And I can't be an exception to that either, in any case. That very evening, straight from the airport, I had arrived after a 14-hour flight across the Atlantic and all the rest of it, in the same car that picked me up, because they had a gathering scheduled. I went straight off to preach. Just enough time to go home, drop off my suitcases, splash some water on my face, and head straight out. And I went. It was the eve of the feast. On the evening of the second day we served Vespers, and for the speaker the program had me down. They had declared a whole week in honor of Saint Nectarios. Every evening a feast, Vespers and a talk, and every morning for a whole week the service followed in remembrance of Saint Nectarios, about his life, about his miracles, about his written work, about this and that, and all the rest of it. The evening of Vespers comes, and I watch the priests arriving, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 10, 15, 16 priests. I see a bishop, a professor of the theological school there, a bishop Gerasimos of Abydos, an educated man, and all of them from universities with 2 or 3 degrees and 2 deacons. In a moment the place was full. And when we say a church, it is 4 times the size of the ones here. 4 times, imagine it. There are seats throughout. Everyone who comes has a seat, unless the church becomes overcrowded. No one is obliged to sit. One can stand in front of the seat. And this one in particular they had bought from the Catholics. And in front there was a little kneeler you could lean on, kneel down on whenever you wanted. Things that the Catholics have as their own particular custom. I sat down in a corner there and watched, and I thought I had found myself at St. Anna's on the Holy Mountain. The service was so thoroughly Orthodox. The chanter was Byzantine, Byzantine, through and through. All the churches over there have Byzantine chanters as well. And the choirs they have there chant in the Byzantine style. They do not sing European music or some mixture. They chant Byzantine. I sat there inside and my eyes filled with tears and I said, "My God, where am I tonight? Am I in America, in the city of atheism, of speed and of materialism, or am I on the holy mountain?" It was a Vespers full of the deepest compunction of catanixis. Then the time came for me to speak. It was embarrassing for me now to stand up in front of 18 of them, 16 and 2 more, that makes 18, and with the bishop 19, and if you count 2 diplomas each, French and English, plus theology, that is 3 diplomas apiece, and I do not know, some of them may have 4, because some come from the Albanian community. There are all kinds of people there who have come to Christ, and each one knows his own language as well, so there must have been something like 75 or 80 diplomas in that room, and I had to stand up and present myself in front of them without a single one. You can understand how a person feels if he has a sense of honor and knows himself, but if he has no sense of honor and is full of pride, then of course he will go up there and crow about himself. I drew myself in. I folded up small, and I made a sign to him, "You're the one who brought me here. Now you do it." And I spoke. I didn't speak my own words, and the people were left stunned. At first they were a little tense, a little closed off. What is this man going to say to us now? Is he going to start scolding us because our beards aren't long? Is he going to start in on us? What's about to happen here? They had swallowed their tongues, and they had taken the 2 front rows of desks, apart from His Eminence, who was on the left, on his throne. Those men sat and listened for 3/4 of an hour. What happened afterwards? I can't tell you, those people, because I didn't tell any lies. I said the things I actually felt. How I went there, how I was feeling then, and how I feel now, and how I would feel if I too let my tongue run loose and started saying, "This one is like this, and that one is like that." Of what you see, believe half, and of what you hear, believe nothing at all. Because if grace were not there, what I saw there could never have happened. So grace is there. And when grace is there, what sort of gnawing little creature are you, sitting here writing them off from a distance and speaking against them? Instead of praying and saying, "My God, I keep hearing that they have lost their faith. I keep hearing that they have been swallowed up. I beg you, do not let this bridgehead be lost, today of all days when it matters so much for mankind, and above all for our church." Which of us prayed? Which one was I praying? If I had never gone to see the Holy Sepulchre, Sinai, the Holy Mountain, would I have prayed? Would I have sounded the call to you to pray for these beacons of orthodoxy? Because if they stop, the Sun of Righteousness will be eclipsed, and it is better that the sun, the moon, and the stars be eclipsed, and that the rest of our life be darkness, than that orthodoxy be lost, and above all in these places? How will it stand? How does orthodoxy still stand over there, in the middle of 280 million atheists? How does it stand? Doesn't that make an impression on us, who prayed for God to hold it up? Christ alone holds it up, and so do those people who are waging a struggle on every side, a struggle no one can even imagine, because they are so scattered across that vast country. How do they hold on to their Greek identity? How are they still able to make the sign of the cross? That is a great thing. And when those people heard a sincere voice, which God of course permitted, they were deeply moved, and that became the reason they began inviting me everywhere afterwards, to come to their conferences, to come to their school, to come to their feast days. I went and spoke at the Holy Archangels in another city. I went and spoke at St. Philip's in another city, at St. Catherine's, and so on. And so on, because they saw that people were being benefited, and that is how it all came about. Now someone might say, "Really? Were we waiting for you to come all the way from Greece to speak to them? With all their degrees, could they not speak for themselves?" But degrees do not speak. They earn their degrees in order to become priests and to learn the doctrine. Degrees do not speak. What did Paul say in Corinth, a passage the Protestants misunderstood? I was not sent to baptize, he says. I was sent to preach, for a baptism. Someone can take the service book and perform it, even if he is uneducated. Even someone without the gift can do that. But to preach, there are people with encyclopedic knowledge who, once they step into the pulpit, cannot put even one sentence together. They may do harm rather than benefit anyone. These men do speak. They also speak on the radio and produce other programs, doing whatever they can. But preaching is needed as well. Indeed, even 20 preachers would still be too few for that country. Even if each of them stayed a month in every city, and even if this happened every single year, so that these people could find some warmth, could find arguments to hold on to, so they could stand up under the pressure coming at them from every other side. There is enormous propaganda over there, and there is propaganda here too, and we swallow it whole. But the written record, the letters, how shall I put it to you, says exactly the opposite. There are private radio stations run by the Protestants and by the Catholics. Protestantism, above all, is doing a work of brainwashing. 600 radio stations attack Orthodoxy night and day. They do not strike against papism. They do not strike against the other heresies. Every one of them speaks against Orthodoxy. There is one man there, a Protestant, who spends $40,000 a day on these broadcasts and on producing material, leaflets, and the rest of it, all of it against Orthodoxy. That money pays to fly him from city to city in a private plane and to rent stadiums and halls for him to speak in. And on the Orthodox side, there are one or two stations that will accept Orthodox programs. Because over there, the other stations don't look at who you are. If you pay, you can be black, you can be yellow, you can be whatever you like. And over there, they still hold discussions over the telephone. I myself could speak to the station right from the office. And the station put it on the air. In the same way, from the church where I was, where I was speaking, they were connected up, and the Orthodox or the Greek speakers who had their radio on were listening in their own homes. But that is a drop in the ocean compared with all the money Protestantism has at its disposal over there. Protestantism and papism have the propaganda as well as money. The Orthodox have 400 churches over there, and perhaps 300 of them were bought from the Protestants because they were standing empty, or from the Catholics. You know about this problem. Orthodoxy there today is the strongest faith. It is the strongest church. And Hellenism is taking firm root there in a positive way, always with the blessing of the church. There is no community, no association of people, without the church at its head. The priest is the president, and then beneath him is the council, through which all the other affairs are administered. Everything comes under the church. Here, however, we are trying to separate ourselves from the church. Why? Do our own people want the blessing of our church? Woe to them! From the moment the church is separated from them, the church will truly become the church, while they will be left naked and exposed, and woe to them if the sirens sound. What a sorry state he will be in! What will become of him? Because no one can hold his ground, standing as if on the ramparts, unless Christ and the Panagia, the All-Holy Virgin, are with them. If Hellenism stood firm, it did not stand firm by its own bravado. It stood with the help of the Panagia and with the help of Christ. So then, in the face of all this frenzy and rage, the only ones resisting are the Orthodox. And not only do the others achieve nothing, but we are gaining ground day by day, and not only in church matters and in Orthodoxy, but as a people as well. You know that we have 4 or 5 people, even 6, inside the legislatures over there, inside the machinery of the state, as congressmen and as senators and so on. You know these things. The day after I arrived, they had elections, and in the place I went to in Boston, 2 of them were our own Greeks. It is a great thing, that bridgehead over there, for that world. The happy thing, which I want to tell you, is this. The Greeks back home are divided, abroad, whether it is out of fear or because they find themselves on their own. They feel an emptiness, and they are forced to come together. You're not losing anything here because of what goes on there. What do people here say? That over there, you know, they have feasts in the church, they have dances in the church, they have all sorts of things. These things go on. They go on and they go too far. No, they simply go on, and you Panagopoulos talk like that. Listen, let me tell you, brother. almost all the basements, 80% of the churches have halls. Halls. Whatever space there is upstairs, there's the same downstairs. Maybe even more downstairs, fine, but can it be that upstairs is the church and downstairs is a hall? Yes, it can. Of course it can, because that's how it should be. Take the Christian who baptizes his little child upstairs. Afterwards, he's going to put on a meal, and he'll go and hold it at a taverna. He'll go and hold it at some restaurant outside, somewhere far away. Instead, he holds it downstairs underneath the church, and there he also has a healthy fear of the church, because the priest is right there, not so the priest can dance, or go flinging off his kalimavki, his clerical hat, but because there's a fitting sense of reverence in that place. Now all the conveniences are there, refrigerators, everything you need for cooking, everything you need for keeping the food. There are proper tables, there are proper chairs, so that the meal that follows or the sweets they hand out after a baptism or a wedding takes place right there. And the money that would have been spent somewhere else stays in the treasury of the community, of the church. The community manages this under the oversight and the blessing of the church, so that it doesn't stray beyond proper limits. It keeps to Christian and Orthodox custom. That is where people will meet one another so that they don't lose their language. They talk about their village. They see one another. Greek matches are made. They marry Greek girls. And the Greek young people are not absorbed into Protestantism, into Catholicism, into Judaism. A great deal of good comes out from under that blessing, of course. Upstairs are the Greeks who are faithful in the church, and downstairs are the Greeks who are not, with the prayer that one day they will come straight up there, up into the church. It doesn't drive people away. It gathers them in, these Greeks, so that they are not absorbed and lost out there. It does not put on dances downstairs in order to create situations where God is blasphemed. It does not permit drunkenness and outrageous things of that kind. And many times the people don't even get up to dance. I was present at festive gatherings over there. Each person takes his food from over there, sits with his own company here, pays his money, and they stay there, because it is a necessity. It is a necessity. People here hear dollars, and what is more, millions of dollars, without knowing where those dollars are spent. In some of the communities I examined, I found and saw that in the 1979 budget, one was assessed $550,000 to give to the archdiocese, another $600,000, another $400,000, and so on and so forth. So a budget comes out at the archdiocese of somewhere around $4, $5, $6 million. Someone will say it's a gift, and it's with this money that the archdiocese is kept going. Meanwhile, the church pays a note every month. It pays the priest, which will be at least $1,000. It pays the chanter and keeps a chanter on. It pays the cleaning woman. It pays for lighting, for heating, and for all the expenses and taxes to the city and to the state. It pays the teacher so that the children can learn Greek letters, or the kindergarten teacher. It pays the elementary school teacher. It pays the teacher of the middle school or the high school. All of this is paid for by the community. Money is needed at the archdiocese level too. The archdiocese maintains the School of Theology in Boston, $600,000. It maintains St. Basil Academy, $400,000. It maintains Greek letters, Greek studies, and so on. Because the state over there doesn't give us the Greek language, it gives us English. If you want to hold on to your language and your Greek heritage, you have to build a school yourself. And every community has a school. Some have a kindergarten, some an elementary school, others a middle school, others a high school, and so on. And each person pays for it. They pay for these things so that the language will be preserved. The children pick up three languages, French, which is compulsory. Since English isn't the required language there, French compulsory. English as a supplement, and then by their own choice, the Orthodox one, the Greek language. All of this is paid for by the Greek community. All of this is paid for by the Patriarchate. That is where the funds begin, and from there they go out to the Patriarchate of Jerusalem, thousands of dollars. I have kept the documentation. I have kept a full statement of it. If anyone doubts it, I can give them the figures, the details, to the Patriarchate of Constantinople, thousands of dollars. Then there are the orphanages they maintain, the academies they maintain, pensions, more pensions, other institutions that are needed, homes for the elderly, 1,001 cases, 30 or 40 separate funds that are kept up, and people are left hearing only dollars, hearing business, hearing money, and so on. But where is all this spent? Where does it go? How many people stand there working out every possible arrangement so that not even a dime, if they can help it, slips away, so that they can meet their obligations? I found myself in one church. It has all the modern equipment. It has a cassette duplicator, several typewriters, a document duplicator, projectors, every kind of modern equipment you can imagine that might be useful. When I attended a service on the evening of the Feast of Saint Nectarios, I saw at least 500 or 600 people, each holding a folder. "What on earth is this now?" I said to myself. Thank God I didn't dare to voice an opinion, because I've been caught out many times before. Many times. Finally, when I saw that they had set them aside over there, I picked one up to see what they had done. They had photocopied the service for St. Nectarios, Vespers and Matins, Orthros. Anyone who wanted could hold a copy and follow along. They do the same for the Divine Liturgy. They have also translated the Divine Liturgy into English. Someone might ask, is it not good in Greek? But they have a group of young people who were born there and do not know Greek at all. They don't know any Greek at all. Shouldn't they learn these things? The Divine Liturgy, what it says inside it. We here criticize them. They lost their language for the sake of the church. But it is a necessity. If I had known English, I would have had to speak in English. As it was, I spoke to the Greek community on the radio and so on. They hear me as a Greek speaker. If I had stayed there that Sunday and Monday, they had invited me to speak on TVs. They gave me 2 hours, one on Sunday and one on Monday. I would have been speaking to Greeks, and the others would only have seen me waving my hands and wondered what I was saying, and it would have been the middle of the night when I came on the screen to speak. Isn't that so? And yet we here have not grasped this at all. The people caught fire. I was speaking to them the way I've been speaking here right up to that moment, and I told them, as long as I live, gentlemen, I will be a fervent preacher of these things that I have seen. I went to a conference of priests, and I saw that these men are wrestling with serious matters. I saw that they genuinely care. Just as we hold all sorts of conferences here, they are thinking about how it can be done, how the emigrant can be helped to come back to the church, and why these people left in the first place, and so on. They gave me the floor twice, and I spoke at their conference within the spirit in which they had invited me, of course, and with that practical bent that in a way marks the way I speak, and the people were left with nothing to say except that, yes, this is how things stand, and this is how it has to be done. Here we always argue against these things. I don't know why. From what I saw there I was, I confess, put to shame, and I came back here with a different opinion and a different way of thinking. I stayed in a priest's house. I was hosted there for 10 days, a very young man, 30 years old, with 3 degrees, French, English, and theology. A kingdom. His wife was born over there, and she only knows English. She studied at St. Basil's Academy, and she has picked up a little Greek, bit by bit. They have 3 children. That place is the promised land. Whatever your mind can imagine and your heart desires, it is easy to have it. Let me just tell you about one house where they invited me last Thursday to set a table for me. They asked me over the telephone, "What would you like? We know you don't eat much. We'll make you fish, since you're unwell," I said. "Well, I am unwell. But isn't there anything else cooked in oil? Couldn't you make me some green beans? Lovely green beans. Okra, eggplants. And what do you think they had for me? Fresh artichokes, fresh broad beans, and Greek cabbage pie." "Ah, don't worry about it," I said. "Whatever your heart desires. Well, in that house on Wednesday and Friday and Monday there was no oil. The priest's wife told me so, because we had talked a little about the 3 fists, fasolia, fava, and faki beans, split peas, and lentils on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And she comes and knocks on my door and says, which of the three will it be today, Mr. Panagopoulos? I said, put on the lentils. Do you understand? When I went. Let me give you a picture of it. When I went to Montreal, everybody rushed to take me into their home. I don't know how God arranged it, but I went to a house that had been corresponding with me from here, without ever having seen the people. What did I find there? I found 6 little children and the lady expecting another, a family with 7 children, the husband's mother made 8, the 2 of them made 10, and me 11. So, because of my work, I often found myself being taken here by some people and there by others. The talks would begin late, and I would return exhausted. Then, when it was time for me to say my prayers, everyone stood up, the children, the grandmother, the lady of the house, and turned toward the icon. They had an icon of the mystical supper in their kitchen. They all stood facing it and made the sign of the cross, while I remained seated. On Wednesdays and Fridays, that entire family ate no oil. And where was this? In the promised land, where you lacked nothing. They could have had anything they wanted, yet they would not even eat oil. So you can understand where that left us. And what does God see there, that He sends people, and He will go on sending people so long as there is willingness on the part of those people? I don't know if you know your geography. I don't know if you know what it is like there as far as the cold is concerned. People were amazed that they had not been shut in by the snow yet, because they are closed in by snow until the end of May, perhaps even into June, especially in Montreal. It lies in a zone at the same latitude as Moscow, just to give you some small idea. I kept saying to them, I said to the father there, listen, I don't want snow, and when the fox doesn't want a thing, nothing comes of it. In 20 days I'll leave, and it will snow. And indeed it did snow, the day before I left. But while I was still shut in up there, one evening at 5:30, the snow set in on the Thursday. In half an hour you have 0.5 meter of snow. Everything closed down. Walking is forbidden there, and you are fined if you don't have galoshes on. If you fall and break your leg, nobody looks after you. You get no compensation. If you break your leg while wearing galoshes, you slipped on the snow, then the insurance pays you, either the shop's insurance or that of whatever other establishment is there. Everything was shut down. The talk was scheduled to begin at 7:30. Thinking like a Greek, I said to myself, where can you go at a time like this? You'll have quite a journey, but get up and go, whatever happens. Yet who would come all the way there now? The snow had been coming down since 5:30. If some old lady had nothing to do at home and went to church early, she'll be there. In any case, I had to go. The result was that the hall was flooded with people. And when we say hall, we are not talking about a few thousand. The balconies were full, the boxes were full, the aisles were full, the sides over here were full. Everything was packed. And outside, the snow was 70 centimeters deep with the windstorm and blizzard sweeping everything before them. Where did all these people come from on the last evening? From Salafili. Where did all these people come from? There was a hunger of the soul there, my beloved, a spiritual hunger. When they heard that I was going to leave, I cannot tell you what happened. Some threw their arms around my neck, others were kissing my hands, others were kissing my feet. Some were pulling me one way, others were pulling me the other way. In other words, the very things we read about. I don't say this for my own sake. I say this thing on God's behalf. Here they speak to 100, and only one listens, if even that one does. The next day, in the snow, they escorted me in a whole procession to the airport, right up until they had put me on the plane and taken a promise from me that I would come again. That I would come back. If you could see how these people who have no daily preaching think and feel and do good works, you would say that God does well, that He sees good people. People came up to me, take this money, $300, $200, $300, $250, $100, you will give it over there, to such and such a church for this particular work, to that one in Veronis, for this work at the Leper Hospital you will find so and so for this work. Anonymous people, evidently, who write letters and send money from there to here. That is to say, doing good is a doctrine for them. It is unthinkable that a day should pass in which they take in a dollar and do not put something aside to give away. It is an astonishing thing. They would not let me pay for anything. I only wanted to buy 2 shirts, the kind that don't crease so they don't need ironing. Because I am always hard pressed, and they would not let me. I wanted to buy 2 undershirts, and they would not let me. They bought them for me, you understand. I am ashamed to be telling you these things. Whatever you might have wanted, they gave you everything. Their hospitality, their love, their simplicity. You cannot imagine it. We are the cunning ones. As I was writing to a gentleman today, I felt like telling him that I felt guilty, because I felt that I was among angels, and that I was a Satan in their midst. And they, on their side, looked at me as though I were an angel, a man sent from God. Do you understand? So then, these people must have our prayers. They, who live a sanctified life, must have our prayers, and may God shelter them. There is a bridgehead over there. It is a great thing for us. Things will change. Hellenism will remain. Orthodoxy will remain. And in spite of the accusations, in spite of this and in spite of that, all of it will remain. Orthodoxy will go forward. Hellenism will take up the task of carrying the light. And that is why God upholds these people. What I have told you is nothing compared with what you would still want to hear regarding the clergy, regarding doctrine, and so on. I will tell you one thing only. The things that are written and discussed here hold no truth. Orthodoxy takes part in everything that goes on there, in the ecumenist affairs as well. And yet it sets forth its positions and presents what is its own. And indeed it has caused many Protestants and many Catholics to think seriously. It has not betrayed the faith. Here, in fact, there is sorrow because certain people from among us came forward who did not conduct themselves as they should have. There, however, they stand firm in the Orthodox positions. And because Orthodoxy has maintained this steadfast position, they have narrowed the 100 or more topics for the council we are preparing down to 10, none of them dogmatic, other matters in their order. So let us not fall upon them, let us not sharpen the knife. Those people are hard-pressed over there. Those people live 100 miles away, 150 miles away. On the Feast of St. Catherine. In the morning, the moment I came down from the pulpit, a husband and wife came up to me. Someone else had telephoned them and was bringing them in from 150 miles away. 150 miles and 16 below. Do you know what that means? 200 and some kilometers. They came, and when they entered, and realized they had missed the sermon, the poor people were beside themselves. So I stood there and spoke to them for 25 minutes. They kept looking at each other. They had never heard the things I told them before. They were good people. They did good works. But they had no connection with Holy Confession. They had no proper organic connection with Holy Communion, so that their good works might also bear fruit. At this point they fall short, it is true, but they need guidance from the people entrusted with this task. God sends such people, that is why our task is not to accuse. Our task is to pray, even when someone is in error. If I accept that this man has sold himself out, then what should I do? Should I go and trample him down? No, I must pray. I must say, my Christ, please do not let the others be lost because of him, but do not let him be lost either. Yet we do not do this. But how do we manage this? Where is love, Christian love, in all of this? That love is not Christian love. And so I would ask you this, on the basis of what I saw and lived, and what made such an impression on me, hold on to it, if you will, and put it into your prayer that this bridgehead may be preserved, and let it not matter to us before God if the priest there has no beard, or if the priest is not wearing his cassock, because over there every priest has to be a driver as well. That is another matter, and it is theirs to deal with there. Let us not rush to judge. Let us dwell on their love and on their orthodoxy. For I saw a priest who in the evening drove the women to their homes over great distances. They had no cars of their own, so the priest took them home. I've seen a priest who picked up an old grandmother and took her to the doctor. I've seen a priest who picked up 4 women in his own car to bring them to church. How do I know why he does this? he does not wear it. But that is none of my concern. My concern is something else, to go and show him respect when he is there celebrating the divine liturgy. Everything else is beside the point. Circumstances are so fluid that I cannot fixate on whether he lacks a beard, and not all of them do. Nor do those of us here who have these outward things possess what they have there, the energy, the love, and the tireless service day and night. What these people need then is prayer and love. That is what we should attend to. Because one day we will give an account, because we did not help those people who are there, in the midst of a population of 280 million, to stand firm. Our help, of course, will only be through prayer, nothing else, and through love in the Lord. So I pray that what God permitted me to bring back from this small experience over there may become for us a landmark with regard to that church as well, and that, together with the Holy Mountain, with the Brotherhood of the Holy Sepulchre, with the Synodal Brotherhood, with the Patriarchate, with the Archbishop, with the whole church, this church too may be in our prayers, because clearly God loves her also. That is all for tonight. Forgive me, and may God forgive you if I have been the cause of any bitterness in you, whether knowingly or